This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Lester Brown is one of the world's leading proponents and pioneers of sustainable development. He's the founder of World Watch and founder and president of Earth Policy Institute. He's also the author of many books and papers calling for stabilizing the population, cutting carbon emissions, addressing food and water insecurity, and restoring forests and grasslands, croplands, and fisheries. He's received many honors, awards, and honorary degrees. Not bad for a poor kid who grew up on a farm in southern New Jersey during the Depression, the child of parents who didn't finish elementary school. Lester Brown's new book, Breaking New Ground, is about those early years and how they set him on his path in the environmental movement. And Lester Brown joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here, Mark.
Nice to have you with us as well. Have you been back to the town or even the house where you grew up?
Oh, yes. I've been back to Bridgeton many times. My sister and brother still live in the community where we grew up. So I get back there at least a few times a year, if not more.
And how different does it look from the Bridgeton of your childhood?
Well, surprisingly, not as different as you might think. And the township in which we grew up, Stoke Creek Township, which is entirely rural, there's no concentrated housing anywhere there, is still quite rural. Mm. I mean, the crops are very different. Back then, there were vegetables and a lot of tomatoes and strawberries and asparagus and things. Now it's mostly shrubs and things being grown for export to
like landscaping, things like that.
Landscaping, yeah.
You describe your dad was a farmer. Your mom worked as a domestic. It sounds like neither of them finished elementary school. You were raised during the Depression, but you grew up in a house that didn't have a radio. You didn't have books. There were no photographs. You didn't celebrate holidays. Did you feel deprived, or was this the way life was in the 30s in southern New Jersey?
I didn't feel deprived. I found life very interesting. And I mean, it's sort of difficult now if you didn't grow up in the area where we did, but in the wintertime, you know, the most popular dinner was muskrats with milk gravy and homemade bread. Muskrats because there were a lot of trappers in the area along the Delaware in the marshes there. And back in the 20s and 30s, muskrat coats were a big deal. So, it was an interesting background. And one of the things I've realized in looking back is that growing up on a farm is an education itself. You really learn a lot. And I feel that I benefited enormously from that.
Well, it sounds like the whole family pitched in, even as a little boy. You and your siblings were helping out on the farm, picking beetles off of crops, for instance.
No question. I remember walking row by row in a tomato field, picking off the Colorado potato beetles and dropping them in a can that had some kerosene in the bottom. Mm-hmm. That's organic insect control.
Hand-picked. Mm-hmm. What does a fried muskrat taste like? I have to ask you that question.
Well, if you've eaten squirrel, muskrat...
No, I haven't, but okay. Yes, okay.
It's similar, but much tastier. I sort of describe muskrat is to squirrel as duck is to chicken. Duck is much more flavorful than chicken, and muskrats are much more flavorful than squirrel or even than rabbit.
And do any of them taste like chicken?
not really. I know they're supposed to. Everything tastes like chicken.
Exactly, which is, yes. You were an early reader. I mean, it sounds like by the time you started school, you were well on your way to being a good student and a good learner.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was a particularly good student, but I was interested in learning. And my grandfather on my mother's side, Granddad Smith, who was of German extraction, taught me to read when I was 4 years old. And I started reading then. And when I got to school, they had to find another grade for me because I just didn't fit in kindergarten. So that was, I read voraciously, and I remember from on report cards in grades 3 through 8, mm-hmm. every teacher commented, "Lester rushes through his work so he can read." Well, I mean, they were interested in class assignments, but I was interested in learning. Period. And so I had my own sort of system, which they eventually
they did not like.
They eventually adjusted to it.
Oh, you got them to adjust to your system.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you were the kind of learner that if you were interested in something or passionate about something, that's where your energies were. But if you weren't so interested, you didn't, what, do the work?
Right. I did very well the things that I was interested in, not so well in the others. So it, right. sort of independent in a sense. But in looking back, it's clear now that wherever I was, whether it was on the farming, in school, and at college, working in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I always had my own agenda. I knew what I wanted to do. When I was hired in the Foreign Agricultural Service in 1958. My assignment was the Rice Bowl countries, but I wanted to learn about the world, and I worked day and night for, you know, 7 days a week to get to know world agriculture until by the end of the first year, I probably knew world agriculture as well as anyone in the world.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me ask you about the tomato farm that you and your brother, you were, what, teenagers, I guess, at the time, mm-hmm. into early adulthood. You had what sounds like a pretty successful tomato farm, and you also sound quite entrepreneurial.
Yeah, I don't know where the entrepreneurial instinct came from, but my brother, my sister, and I, all three seemed to have it to some degree. What my brother and I did, I mean, we lived on a farm, and we had chores to do. We had cows to milk and things to do. But once we got our chores done, Pop, you know, gave us free rein to do whatever we wanted to do. So we, and this would have been in 1951, I guess, we... I was 17. My brother was 14. We bought an old tractor, J.I. Case tractor, and got it running. We bought it for $200, wow. money we'd made picking tomatoes and strawberries and things. We grew our first crop of tomatoes, 7 acres, 28,000 tomato plants, and had a really good crop and made enough money to buy a new tractor.
Yeah.
So I decided that I was a freshman at Rutgers then. So I decided that my brother should be the one to buy the new tractor.
Since he was 14 years old, right?
Right. So he went to the local farm equipment dealer and started talking to him about buying a tractor. And they couldn't take him seriously, of course, because he was just a kid. But they finally realized that he really did want a tractor, and he really could pay for it.
And so they sold it to him.
Yeah. So that was sort of exciting.
Well, I guess at the height of your farming career, if I can say that, you had about, what, 70 acres, 280,000 tomatoes?
280,000 tomato plants, right. Yeah. That was the, in 7 years, we went from 28,000 plants to 280,000 plants, a tenfold expansion. And by that time, we were, or I was, because we had sort of divided things, and Carl had gone off with his own business, but we had 280,000 tomato plants, which is a lot of tomatoes.
So do you think you'd be a farmer when you, quote-unquote, grew up?
Yeah. That was the goal, but by the time we were growing this many tomato plants, I realized, I mean, we're one of the biggest tomato growers in New Jersey, certainly at the time. But I realized that, you know, just growing more tomatoes the next 40 years wouldn't be that challenging or satisfying. And then I also had a chance just before that to live in villages in India under the International Farm Youth Exchange Program administered by the National 4-H Club Foundation. And that was just a fascinating experience. And I realized in retrospect at the time I didn't think it had changed me. And people say, you know, how's it changed? I say, I really, really haven't changed. But looking back, it's clear it did change things. And so then I began thinking about working with world agriculture, and that's what led me to the Foreign Agricultural Service in Washington.
You write, you went to Rutgers University, and the best course you ever took was one that had a book called You Can Talk Well. And that has served you, I guess, well in your career.
Yeah, the to graduate from the College of Agriculture, you had to have 1 year of public speaking. And the professor who taught that was Richard Rieger, R-E-A-G-E-R. And he was the author of the college textbook at the time, You Can Talk Well, or You Can Speak Well. And so taking that course didn't make you a great speaker, but at least you learned the principles of how to engage an audience. And I had no idea when I took that course that one day I would be declining $50,000 speaking fees. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine. In fact, I've declined a couple in recent months, one for 50 and one for 60, just because I wanted to spend the time writing instead. But
it must have taught you something.
Yeah. And I enjoy the challenge of communicating, whether it's in speaking or in writing, taking complex sets of issues and putting them in terms that the people can understand.
You mentioned your trips to India, and it seemed that in one of those trips to India, you began to see the problem, I guess, of overpopulation. What did you see that got you on this path?
Well, when I arrived in India in 1956, I was just amazed at how many people there were. I remembered being interviewed on radio in Bombay, and they said, you know, what are your impressions? I said, there sure are a lot of people here.
An understatement, I guess.
Yeah. And there are only, I think, 380 million then, and now they're 1.3 billion. So the population issue hasn't gone away, and I think it's going to be I think we're going to have a lot of problems coming down the road with this one.
Well, in fact, this is back in the 50s, you predicted serious problems of famine and hunger and malnutrition because of this huge population.
Right. And there was a situation in, I think it was 1965, where I had been asked to go to India to review the agricultural part of India's forthcoming five-year plan. But when I got there, I began to notice things. Like I was talking with a guy from Esso, now ExxonMobil, and, you know, at a reception, I said, you know, how's business? Oh, he said, it's really booming. He said, the farmers are pumping day and night. He said, they're buying a lot of irrigation fuel. They're trying to save their crops from the drought. And then I talked with a guy that I wanted to meet with in the embassy when I arrived in India on that trip, and he wasn't going to be there. He was going to be hunting. He went to a lake up north every year, and I said, well, how come you're here? I thought you're going to be hunting. Right. He said, I would be, but there's no water in the lake. So I began putting these things together, and then as now, I read four or five newspapers every morning before I started work, and I began to see that India was facing a huge shortfall.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Lester Brown, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, founder of World Watch, also founder and now president of the Earth Policy Institute. And he's got a new book. He's written about 50 of them. This one is a memoir. It's called Breaking New Ground. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY and presents Handel's inspiring Messiah with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Philadelphia Singers Chorale, and Soloists. The Messiah of the Season. 215-893-1999 for Messiah tickets or at philorc.org. Sunday, December 22nd, one performance only at the Kimmel Center, the Philadelphia Orchestra presents Handel's Messiah.
It's the time of year when walkways turn icy. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll suggest an alternative to de-icing chemicals that's actually good for your soil. Plus, returning veterans trained to become organic farmers, and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, an exhibit of Jewish artifacts from Baghdad on display in Washington is bringing back memories for Iraqi Jews who had to flee the country.
for me, this is more than gold. It is a part of my heritage. It is an evidence that I have where I came from.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Lester Brown. He is the first to graduate in his family from elementary school, grew up in southern New Jersey during the Depression, has received honorary degrees from over 25 universities, including Villanova University, recipient of many awards, including the 1986 MacArthur Genius Award, author of a new book called Breaking New Ground. It's in part a memoir and also a discussion, a description of his work on sustainable development, his interest in population, food and water, and climate change. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You mentioned back in the 1950s being in India and they had a serious problem of a water shortage. How about today? Have we figured out how to have sustainable water in this world?
No, and to stay with India for a minute, one of the things that's happened in India in recent years is that farmers have been drilling irrigation wells by the million, literally. You don't have to have a license in India to drill an irrigation well. So 26 million farmers have drilled irrigation wells. As a result, the water table in India is falling every year in every state in the country. And at some point, the wells will start to go dry. In fact, they are already going dry in some areas. So the water issue looms very large in India's future.
How about for other countries, including the United States?
Not so much for the United States, because most of our grain is produced in the Midwest. The Corn Belt, which is an extraordinarily productive piece of agricultural real estate. Just to put that point in perspective, the state of Iowa produces more grain than Canada and more soybeans than China at the same time. I mean, it's amazing. We take for granted this huge amount of prime cropland in the Midwest. It goes from Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, et cetera. But it makes us the world's leading agricultural superpower.
I'm trying to imagine, what does a country do if they run out of water? I know Yemen, for instance, has a serious water shortage, a quite arid part of the world. But nonetheless, what does a country do if they don't have water?
Well, the first countries to literally run out of irrigation water are the Arab countries in the Middle East, like Yemen, like Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq. These countries have had to turn to the world market for a large share of their food. In fact, the Saudis say that by 2016, they'll be out of the grain production business altogether, totally dependent on grain imports to feed their Canada-sized population of about 30 million.
You say, talking about water, that about 80% of water is used for irrigation, the rest 20% used for what, drinking, cooking, things like
for
that?
For residential and industrial uses. Mm-hmm. Irrigation is the big thing in terms of the world water balance.
I mean, we think of peak oil, but now that I'm thinking peak water. I mean, is that how we should think about water?
Yeah, I think we have passed peak water. Unfortunately, we don't have good enough data for water use throughout the world so we can compare year to year. But we do know that there's extensive overpumping now of underground water in the western Great Plains of the U.S., in the North China Plain that produces half of China's wheat and a third of its corn, just to cite the two big grain producers where we have overpumping. You can overpump in the short run, but not in the long run. And then the other big three grain producer is India, which I've just been talking about, where they're overpumping on a scale we've never seen before.
Mm. Are there too many people on the planet?
Well, when you look at what's sustainable and what's not, it turns out that we're sustaining the current population by overpumping, overplowing, overcutting forests, overgrazing grasslands. We're now in the process of creating two huge dust bowls, one in western China. Just to put that in focus, the U.S. U.S. and China each have about 100,000 head of cattle. The U.S. has 9 million sheep and goats. China has 282 million sheep and goats. And they're literally devegetating most of western and northern China, creating a huge dust bowl. Same thing has happened in the Sahelian region of Africa. It goes all the way from Senegal across to Somalia, overgrazing, a huge dust bowl forming there. And no institutional mechanism in place to reverse that.
Mm. So how do you reduce population? I mean, there are the horrible ways, of course, through starvation and wars and things like that. But what's a more humane way to deal with this issue?
Yeah, there are two ways of stabilizing population. One is to reduce birth rates, and the other is to fail to shift to smaller families, and rising death rates will then kick in.
Mm.
I think the population issue is one of the most underestimated issues we face, and most people don't even talk about it. I don't think President Obama's ever mentioned the population issue in a speech he's given, for example. It's sort of off the table, but it is huge. We're adding 80 million people a year, which means there will be 219,000 people at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night. And at some point, that will come to an end.
Well, especially if the world begins to live the way Americans do, right? The way we use our natural resources.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between the average person in India and the average person in this country is that in India, grain consumption is about 400 pounds per person per year, about a pound a day. When you only have a pound a day, you can't afford to convert much of that into animal protein. In the U.S., we consume about 1,600 pounds of grain per year, or about several pounds per day. We can only actually directly consume a small share of that, so we consume most of it in the form of meat, milk, and eggs.
How about is it possible to have, I mean, we do have better, I guess, bigger crop yields today than probably when you were starting out as a farmer. Is that one of the solutions, or a solution to trying to feed all these billions of people?
Well, one of the most interesting developments in recent years has been that grain production, grain yields in many countries have hit what I call the glass ceiling. We've eliminated nutrient constraints. We've eliminated soil moisture constraints. Then the remaining constraint is the process of photosynthesis itself. And once you reach that level, there's no place to go. Yields level off, and they've leveled off in Japan 17 years now, France, Germany, rice yields in China. More and more countries now are hitting this glass ceiling. So it's making it more difficult to expand world food production fast enough. This is why world grain prices have doubled over the last 7 years.
And that's Lester Brown, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, the founder of the World Watch Institute, the Earth Policy Institute, where he is currently the president. He's written more than 50 books, many of them having to do with exactly what we're talking about: population, food, water, climate change. And his new book is a memoir. It's called Breaking New Ground, and taking calls, questions, comments, covering a lot of territory in this hour of Radio Times. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I said to you before we went on the air, you know, is there anything that we can feel good about when it comes to environmental issues and sustainability? Because it feels as if every day there's one bad news story after another. You mentioned two of them to me, one having to do with coal plants here in the United States.
Right. I had lunch yesterday with the woman who's coordinating the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. They have recently celebrated their 150th coal plant closing in the United States. Their goal is to close every coal plant. There are 380 left, and they're just going to keep going until they close them all. That's an exciting development. And the other exciting development is in the other major economy in the world, which is China. The Chinese are now building 7 wind mega complexes, each of which will have at least 20,000 megawatts of generating capacity. I mean, think 20 nuclear power plants. Mm. The largest one will be in Inner Mongolia, and it is scheduled to have 38,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity. That's enough to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland. I mean, we've never seen thinking an investment in the energy sector on this scale before. It's extraordinarily exciting, and to see the Chinese moving out so boldly in this area is an indication, I think, of where the world's going to be going.
But do you think the U.S. should be out in the forefront on this issue?
We should be, and we were leading the Chinese until a year or two ago, and the Chinese have overtaken us now. In China, wind generation has also passed nuclear generation, so wind is sort of in a class by itself now.
One of the critiques, I don't know if it's correct or not, which is, of course, you know, winds come and go. Certain parts of the world are windier than others. Is it a kind of energy that can sustain an economy, a complicated economy such as ours? Do you think it can?
No question. There are four states in Germany, for example, in northern Germany, that now get between 40% and 50% of their electricity from wind, and they're doing very well, and they intend to keep going. In Denmark, as a country, it's now 30% of all the electricity from wind. They're planning to go to 100%. These things are manageable. I mean, we think the wind blows sometimes and not others, but the larger the grid gets, the more stable wind becomes. In this country, two of our states, Iowa and South Dakota, get 25% of their electricity from wind. They've had no trouble managing it at all.
So do you see wind as leading the forefront ahead of sun, you know, water, that kind of thing, in terms of sustainable energy?
Solar. We're not going to get much more from hydropower. That's pretty well developed. But we're going to get a lot from solar, and we're going to get a lot from wind, and which dominates sort of depends on where in the world things are located. But what's happening with solar is that the cost of rooftop solar installations, solar cells to generate electricity, has dropped to the point where it's now actually pretty cheap. And so we're seeing almost an explosion in the number of rooftop solar installations in this country and around the world. But what happens here is that as these rooftop installations reduce the demand for utility-generated power, the utilities have to raise their prices to compensate for the shrinkage in their market because they have to maintain the same infrastructure. So suddenly this begins to feed on itself. And it's an amazing thing to see. But, economists are talking about utilities being in an economic death spiral because the more rooftop generators there are, the smaller their market is and the more they have to raise their price and they just eventually are no longer competitive.
You talked about closing some of these old coal plants. Do you believe in clean coal? Do you think such a thing exists?
No.
No?
No.
Do you think it's a scam or it's an attempt to try to...
It's a PR program sponsored by a very desperate coal industry. Clean coal, I mean, they maybe got some of the pollutants out, but the big problem is the CO2. And when you burn coal, you always get carbon dioxide, and that's driving climate change.
So you can't have clean burning coal?
No.
We're in Pennsylvania, Marcellus Shale. I'd be curious about where you stand or what you think about natural gas, and then I do want to get to our callers.
Natural gas is appealing in some ways, but it's still, and it doesn't generate as much carbon as coal, about half as much per unit of energy produced, so it's still disrupting climate, just not quite as fast. So I don't think natural gas is going to be part of the long-term solution. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be solar and wind, and we're seeing enormous growth in both of these. And the other thing is that natural gas is a fossil energy source, and it's going to run out one of these days. These gas fields and oil fields and coal mines don't last forever, and at some point you have to look for new. The great thing about wind is it never runs out, and how much you use today does not affect how much is available tomorrow.
So do you see it as a kind of transition fuel or just sort of knowing that there's a finite amount and eventually it will not be there?
At best, a transition fuel.
Let me get, looks like Leslie from Doylestown to join our conversation. Leslie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very interested in what you're talking about. We are specifically about food and sustainability, hunger, feeding the population both here in the United States and across the world. Regarding GMO crops and the fact that most of the commodity crops that the author has been speaking of are fed to animals, And what would happen if some of those beautiful croplands were used to actually grow food for people? And how would that affect not only sustainability because of the not using the amazing amount of chemicals that's required for those GMO crops, but also because the food that would be grown would actually be feeding people rather than feeding animals.
Well, Leslie, let me give Lester Brown, go ahead. It looks like you want to jump through the microphone there.
I think I counted at least four questions.
Yes,
there,
indeed.
Leslie.
I think I did too, but that's okay. Go ahead.
In looking at the amount of grain that we use to produce meat, milk, and eggs, it is substantial. If we look at the world's big three grains, we have wheat and rice. Those are the world's two food staples. The feed grain is corn, and the corn harvest is now larger worldwide, is now larger than either the wheat or the corn harvest, not because we eat much of it directly, but because most of it goes to feed meat, milk, and eggs. And the big growth in the use of corn right now is coming in China because we have rapid rise in incomes, and we have 1.3 billion Chinese who want to live like Americans, so they're moving up the food chain.
Meaning that they're eating meat, more meat.
Meat, milk, and eggs, yep. And that takes grain. So the fastest growing growth in the world today for grain is corn, and that growth is centered in China.
What about corn for fuel? You know, there's a whole kind of, I guess, controversy about biofuels, whether taking something out of the food supply and using it for energy.
Yeah, I think it's a big mistake. We should be running our cars on electricity, and we're moving in that direction with plug-in hybrids and all-electric cars. That's going to develop much faster, I think, than most people realize, partly because electricity is so cheap. The cost of driving a car that has an electric motor instead of an internal combustion engine, the cost of fuel is about one-fifth. So it's a huge difference. And I think once people realize the economics of using electricity rather than burning gasoline or fuel for crops, I think electricity is going to take over. And I think wind is going to be the big source of cheap electricity.
But we're almost up in a break here. But do you feel like we're at some kind of a crossroads when it comes to our way of life, what is sustainable?
In many ways, we are, and we're seeing also some cultural changes. For example, young people today are not part of the car culture in the way that my generation was, or
mine as well.
It's changed, and this came up at NASCAR recently when they were looking at a film of their audience. And they realized that all the people watching NASCAR races have hair the color of mine, that is, it's white or gray. And they sort of panicked, and they realized they've got to get young people out. But young people really aren't interested in horsepower.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Lester Brown, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Again, founder of the World Watch Institute, a founder and current president of the Earth Policy Institute, the winner of many awards and honors, including a MacArthur Fellowship. And he's got a new book. It's a memoir called Breaking New Ground. And we're covering a lot of ground in this hour of Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Widener Law supports WHYY. Widener Law alumni are serving as judges, corporate lawyers, government officials, and more. In addition to engaging in challenging courses, Widener Law students work on real cases in law clinics. A JD information session will be held on January 11th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Delaware campus. Again, that's January 11th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Registration is available online at law.widener.edu/admissions. Widener Leadership works.
All is lost here, except for soul and body.
Robert Redford has a solo performance in the new film about a man lost at sea. On the next Fresh Air, Redford talks about that role, growing up, getting kicked out of college, starring in early episodic TV, and the film that made him famous, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. the doctor-patient relationship in a disaster.
The reason that some of us are drawn to disaster medicine is because, for me, it's the absolute purest form of medicine.
A doctor talks about helping people nearly beyond help in the typhoon-devastated Philippines. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me read something from Lester Brown's new book, A Breaking New Ground. He writes more broadly, and this is at the very end of his book, "My own work, indeed my life over the last half century, has been shaped by the realization that it is my generation that has moved the world onto an economic path that is not environmentally sustainable, a path that has headed us for decline and collapse. The challenge of reversing this process has shaped my life." True. I mean, you wrote that, and I'm assuming you wrote that because what you worry about the future of the planet and civilization.
Yeah, most scientists recognize quite clearly that we cannot continue on the current mm-hmm. path. We've got to change direction rapidly and stabilize the economy's natural support system, forests and grasslands and fisheries and soils and aquifers and so forth. And they're all under mm-hmm. threat now. I mean, they're deteriorating, and that's what happened to the earlier civilizations whose archaeological sites we now study, like the Sumerians or the Mayans or what have you. They began putting too much pressure on their systems, and they declined and eventually collapsed.
But why do you think it's your generation that did this? And it seems like it came out of this promise of technology and highways and all of that.
The growth in the world economy in the past 60 years or so has probably been at least fourfold, something of that order of magnitude. I mean, it's not a marginal increase of 20% or 30%. I mean, we've increased it several fold. And in the process, I mean, the living standards of many of us have gone up. We consume at a level we couldn't have imagined a half century ago. But it's not sustainable. That's mm-hmm. the bottom line. We've got to rethink things. We've got to simplify things. More bicycles, fewer cars. I mean, another encouraging development is the bike share programs. I don't know how Philadelphia ranks, but almost every city in the country now has a bike share program. And it's not only the bikes available at the program, but it affects how people think about bikes and transportation. So more people are using their own bikes as a result of the bike share program.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like we have Tony from Center City, Philadelphia. Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
So, with respect specifically to food shortage issues discussed earlier,
yes.
I was recently a part of a presentation from a commercial venture that described the concept of urban agriculture, wherein they have rows and rows in a big warehouse-style grow room. Utilizing hydroponics and aeroponics and the like, and light manipulation for very robust yields and such. And I'm wondering if those types of concepts are gaining any kind of strength or support in terms of food shortage issues and globally.
Sure.
as an option.
Tony, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lester Brown, go ahead.
Yeah. Urban agriculture has a lot of potential. I mean, we saw this most clearly in World War II with victory gardens, where everyone that had any space at all was planning a victory garden. It was the thing to do in support of the war effort. And I've forgotten the exact numbers, but the supply of home-produced vegetables got up to like 30% of the total supply or something like that. It was surprisingly large. But we're also somewhat limited by the amount of solar energy that's available to produce edible food, or indeed plants of any kind. One often sees these multi-story glass structures, but what people forget is that you don't really gain. There's no net gain associated with that. All you're doing is putting some of your neighbors in a shadow and using their sunlight to produce your food in this multi-story structure. So it's not really a solution, though it often pops up as a way of solving the food problem.
Tony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what John from West Philadelphia has to say. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I've read a number of your books and delighted that you're on the air. And
wow.
You've written that we need to have the kind of transition to sustainable energy like the transition in World War II from consumer production to war production at that time, but this time from fossil fuel energy to sustainable energy. And I'm wondering how you think we can do that, and can we do it fast enough to prevent a 2-degree increase in global warming that most ecologists think would be a disaster if it came to pass.
John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mr. Brown, go ahead.
Yeah, the key to stabilizing climate is restructuring the energy system, moving from fossil fuels, from coal and oil and natural gas, to wind and solar and geothermal. And it seems like a huge undertaking, and it is. But when we go back to World War II and we realize that in 1942, we totally restructured the U.S. industrial economy. We'd been producing cars and trucks and so forth, and we shifted almost overnight to tanks and planes and ships. I mean, in January 6, 1942, a month after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, thousands of ships, and people couldn't imagine how to do that. But what they didn't know was that he was going to ban the sale of cars, and all of the automobile assembly plants would have to start producing tanks and planes on their assembly lines. So we totally restructured the U.S. industrial economy, not in decades, not in years, but in a matter of months.
But I wasn't alive at the time, but I can imagine that if you're at war, there's a certain kind of psychology that kicks in, and thinking this is going to be something we're going to do temporarily because eventually this war will end, and then we can go back to our lifestyle that we enjoyed before.
Yeah, in both cases, there are threats to survival. In World War II, it was the threat to democracy as a way of life. Today, it's a threat to the threat is climate change that could alter everything, as one of the callers mentioned earlier. And the question is, how do we restructure the energy economy fast enough to avoid runaway climate change? It's doable. Not enough people are yet convinced that we not only have to change, but we have to change quickly. But we do know that there is a model in our history which shows how quickly we can change if we decide to do so.
But do you think we have a political system that would enable that to happen?
It's the same system that we had in
19... But it's got different players.
Different players. But the question is when we reach the tipping point and become convinced that climate change is a threat to our future and our children and grandchildren. Right. And when we realize that, then I think we'll be able to change things quickly.
And what do you think that would take? I mean, we have droughts. There's all sorts of absolute evidence of climate change. And I think more and more people are signing on to this, but nonetheless, not everyone has.
We haven't reached the tipping point yet. I mean, in thinking about social change, I use various models. One I call the Berlin Wall model. We didn't see the Berlin Wall coming down. I mean, it happened, and then we could sort of figure out the social forces at work in East Germany that led to it. But no one said, you know, watch out, the Berlin Wall is going to come down. We just didn't see it. There's not a single article in foreign affairs journals that anticipated that, and yet it happened.
Let me ask you about something that has gotten in the news recently, having to do, they're called climate refugees. These are people who live on, let's say, parts of the Philippines, like a completely flooded islands where the ocean is rising and these islands are disappearing. These are called climate refugees, people that literally are losing their homes because of rising oceans.
Yeah.
And bigger storms.
It's conceivable that I coined that term probably 15 years ago.
We'll have to Google you.
And we see countries like Bangladesh, for example, where half the country is only 1 meter above sea level. You get a 1 meter rise in sea level and half the country's gone and you're displaced 70 million people. Climate change is for real, and rising sea level is going to be one of the issues, and that's where parts of the East Coast, like where we are here in Philadelphia, will suffer from that. And if the Greenland ice sheet were to melt, just that, nothing else, it would raise sea level 23 feet. I mean, South Jersey wouldn't exist anymore.
In fact, you're right. Greenland is, in a sense, a metaphor for our global society.
It is indeed. If we can save the ice in Greenland, we've got a chance. If we can't save it, we're in trouble.
Let me get Anna from, looks like Narberth, to join our conversation. Anna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling because I keep hearing about all of these things that are happening in the world, and I'm trying really hard to do my part bit by bit as an individual, and I'm wondering, water is a big issue for me. Is there anything that you can recommend that somebody can do on a day-to-day basis just to help with the issue of the water disappearing in the world and water quality in the world? And I'd love to be able to teach my children just like the idea of, you know, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. Is there something that you can help us with water as well? And thank you very much. I'll take my call off here.
Anna, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
You know, the what you just described in simplifying diets and so forth and moving down the food chain is the most important single thing that any one of us can do to save water. Keep in mind that 80% of all the water we use in the world is for irrigation. So if you can move down the food chain and reduce the demand for grain, you're reducing the demand for water. It's in simplifying diets, more vegetables and less meat and animal protein, that will not only make us healthier, it'll also greatly reduce the demand for water in the world.
Do you understand bottled water? I mean, I think it's great that people are drinking water as opposed to sodas, but nonetheless, when you learn about how this water arrives, you know, in a 7-Eleven somewhere, it's kind of shocking.
The thing that amazes me is that so many well-educated people sort of think bottled water is something they need. I mean, in the first place, I don't know about here, but in Washington, the bottled water in the supermarket there is actually tap water from Baltimore put in bottles and sold for 1,000 times as much as you would pay
Truly?
For tap water. Yes, yes. I mean, you cost out these bottles and compare them with the cost for that amount of tap water, and you see how much we're prepared to spend. And it's a huge con job, and the industry has convinced people that bottled water is somehow good. Interestingly, in most states in the United States, the regulations on tap water, on public water systems, are more demanding, more stringent, and lead to cleaner, better water than the regulations on the bottled water industry, which is a very different set of regulations and very lax.
Let me get back to our callers. We have, it looks like, John from Gilbertsville joining us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't think that it's an either-or in terms of the suggestions that you've made about our changes in energy use. But what I put to you is that we're raising most of our protein from the land. And if we were instead, and I'm not referring to fishing, but if we were growing more plant material on the oceans, how would that change this calculation in terms of population sustainability?
John, are you talking about fish? Or are you talking about?
No. I'm talking about actually growing plant material on the sea.
I hear you. Okay, go ahead.
Yep. One can grow any plants hydroponically. That is in water. But the economics do not work out. What we do have in the oceans is a natural food chain where you have the algae and then you have the protozoa and you keep building up on the chain to eventually get small fish, then the bigger edible fish that we prize, like salmon, for example, or tuna or what have you. The oceans are limited in how much they can produce because of this system. The fish have to be fed. The advantage of fish farming is that the amount of feed it takes to produce a pound of protein is less than it is for cattle in a feedlot, for example. Mm-hmm. The conversion rates, just to provide some perspective, cattle in a feedlot takes about 7 pounds of grain for 1 pound of live weight. For pigs that are more efficient, about 3 pounds of grain per pound of live weight. For chickens, about 2 pounds of grain per pound of live weight. And then when you get to catfish and carp, it almost becomes 1-to-1. So the most efficient fish that we produce in the world are carp and catfish.
Are you gloomy about our future?
Maybe I should be, but I, you know, having seen the economy come out of the Great Depression and realize what an extraordinary achievement that was, and having seen the advances in technology that enable us to support ourselves so well today. Some technologies which will not last very long, the use of fossil fuels, for example, that's clearly limited, but I think we're going to, I think we can produce enough food. I think we can produce enough energy. I think we're going to rethink lifestyles, diets, transportation. When I was growing up, you know, age 17, a driver's license, and you got something to drive. Everyone did it.
Right.
Young people aren't doing that today. They're thinking very, very differently. They socialize over the internet and with cell phones and so forth. So we're seeing some basic cultural changes that I think are going to help in this transition to a sustainable world economy.
Well, Lester Brown, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Us as well. And Lester Brown, our guest, his new book, and it's his 50-plus books that he's written. It's called Breaking New Ground, and it's a memoir subtitled A Personal History. And again, he is the president of the Earth Policy Institute. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archive, podcast, satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.